Hello and welcome to Dr. Medki, a collaborative learning initiative between the AI Campus and the Charité, Universitätsmedizin Berlin. My name is Marina Lex and I'm a PhD student in Professor Dr. Kerstin Ritter's research group at Charité. This season, we will explore medical applications and regulations with international experts around the world. In today's episode, we will be focusing on the role of AI in healthcare across Africa, exploring how AI tools are making a positive impact in medical care. I'm excited to discuss this important topic with Ayomide Awoyemi, our guest today. Welcome, Ayomide.
Thank you very much.
Can you introduce yourself to our listeners and tell us a bit about your journey from working as a clinician and public health physician in Nigeria to your PhD research in health informatics at the University of Illinois at Chicago?
Yeah, thank you very much, Marina. It's a pleasure to be on this podcast, and I look forward to the discussion we're going to have. So to just give a little bit of insight into my background, I studied medicine in Nigeria, and I practiced for about, I would say, 3 years. But I really did not like sitting and consulting patients. Nothing against patients, but it just wasn't my thing. So I decided to take a pivot and go on to the public health side of things. So I decided to do a master's in public health in the University of Lagos in Nigeria. And then after that, I worked as a consultant for a global fund project that was implementing the strategy for managing HIV/AIDS in Nigeria. So working with the Lagos State Government and then the Global Fund to implement that project in a couple of areas. I was managing a couple of facilities and a lot of workers, and then sort of did that for about 2 years, 8 months. And then after that, I resumed a PhD at the University of Illinois at Chicago. And, you know, the thing that sort of changed in that sort of trajectory is that when I was in medical school, I worked on building my first startup, worked with two other medical students, and we ran it for like a year or two. It was sort of created a platform where people like healthcare students could get materials for either making presentations or reading. Basically, these were materials that were created by Nigerian lecturers in that way. But we sort of got busy with school, and then that sort of went off. But after I finished my master's, I started my third startup, actually. Second one didn't really get off ground. I started my third startup, and it was a healthcare access and information platform that we ran for about 5 years. And then we eventually sold it in 2022 to another Nigerian startup. So I sort of realized that my interest, my passion sort of lies in using technology to improve healthcare access, healthcare outcomes for people. But my background is in clinical medicine and public health. So I sort of felt like, what is the nexus between those two areas? And that was health information sciences. Because one of the things I would love to do in the future is to, somewhere down the line, teach, even though I would love to keep working as an entrepreneur. So I decided to do a PhD. And finished my PhD last month. And my work during my PhD was on how to build better AI systems that would be impactful and useful in the clinical setting. And so that has been sort of my trajectory over time, from medical school all the way to where I am right now.
Yeah, that's great that you have so many different backgrounds. You were a physician, but you also studied informatics and you got a background in kind of medicine and informatics. What motivated you to focus on AI and digital health in your career?
I would say my pivot to AI sort of happened around my second year in my PhD. So, AI had always been there. It was sort of very interesting. But when I first started, my interest mostly was around what we usually call consumer health informatics, like how you build tools directly for people. So not specifically AI, any kind of digital tool that is appealing to, that is targeted at the general population, which was what my startup then was focused on. But I had the chance to do a clinical sort of lab rotation where I was able to work with a project that was trying to support an industry startup to validate the AI they had built. They were sort of building a tool to sort of help patients better manage their care journey much better. So I worked on that project. I helped with writing the grant application. I helped with filing the IRB. And I was sort of found that very interesting. I sort of realized that, you know, there's something special in that area. You know, and it was sort of the buzz of for AI was sort of getting bigger at that time. You know, AI had always been used in medicine for years, but you know, it was sort of becoming a bigger buzz around that time. So I sort of felt like, okay, it looks like this will be, in a few years to come, this will be like one of the most dominant areas in this field. And it would be very good for me to sort of, you know, take a strategic place in that sort of trajectory. So I decided to change from the lab I was to that lab. So I didn't change fully. I sort of split my time between those two labs. So I sort of started working in the other lab where they were sort of focused more on data science approaches and practices for using that. But prior to that time, I had taken online classes on machine learning. So I took an open source machine learning course. So during my PhD, too, I started taking a couple of classes. I started taking data science classes because for my PhD, I started to go through what I would call the data science track. So that sort of, everything just sort of came together and then sort of focused more on that. And then I think about 3 years ago, 2 years ago, I switched fully to that project on AI. And so, and I was sort of working on that till the end of my PhD. So as part of my PhD, I worked on a couple of AI projects, worked as a domain expert for some, worked as a data engineer for some. I worked as a, I was helping with sort of managing their data, helping them to understand. So I was sort of working with the AI engineers on a couple of projects to help them understand the nuances of healthcare data, because some of the AI engineers were people that didn't have healthcare backgrounds. So you need to understand how two things interact. You see something and there's a confounder. So I was sort of helping them to navigate that process. And then eventually we got a grant where I worked on a project where we built machine learning models to help clinicians better find patients who might have long COVID. But prior to all this time, actually, even before I started working in those labs, I had worked on a couple of AI projects on my own. So sort of worked on two open source, on one open source AI project, which was the health systems, health insurance recommender system that we built. This was way before I started working in that lab as for my PhD. And I was one of the people that wrote code for that project. So it was sort of a mix of events of, you know, working on open source projects, taking data science classes, taking classes on machine learning, and then getting the chance to work in labs where AI was like some of the focus of the project. So that's how I sort of pivoted into that area.
Really interesting to hear how you first got in touch with AI and continued that path. You've been involved in building AI-driven healthcare tools in Africa, including Nigeria's first AI-based health insurance recommendation system and the first COVID triage tool in Africa. So let's start with the AI health insurance recommender system. Could you tell us more about this project and its impact?
Yes, yeah, so the AI-based insurance recommendation system was just something I felt at the time that we could do to help people find it easier to choose the best health insurance for them. So a bit of a background. So in Nigeria, the way the health insurance works is there's a government sort of supported and funded one, which is like the National Health Insurance Scheme that is sort of mostly covers people who work for the government. But, you know, regular people can also apply to that. But a lot of people do not really get to use that for a lot of reasons, a lot of paperwork. But there are the private HMOs that manage care on behalf of people. And then they collect premiums and then they help sort of act as payers on behalf of people. Now, in Nigeria, there are about, I think there are about 50 of those. More than 50. Every year they review them, they delete some. But on average, there are about 50 of them. And then for those 50, each of them has about 3 healthcare plans under them. So let's say a random person wants to decide, like, okay, today I want to buy health insurance. How do you decide which one you want to choose among the 50? And then even among the 50, how do you decide the one you want to choose in those plans? Some of them have 5 plans, some have 3, some have 2. So how do you decide how do you choose the best one? And that's a very difficult process because I know a couple of people have approached me at different times and they've asked me that which one is the best health insurance or which one would be the most fit for them, for their purpose. And I've sort of had to advise them because I sort of realized that there's a way we could use technology to sort of smoothen this process. So what we decided to do was to build a recommendation system that is based on your personal preferences matched against the specific features that those health insurance organizations offer. But one of the challenges we initially had was that there was no data. There was no aggregated data where you had all these health insurance companies and their plans. So it didn't exist. There was no way you could find that. If you want to buy health insurance, you have to go to each of their websites, click through a couple of things, and then read five things, go to another one. That is a very cumbersome and tiring process. So one of the first things we did was to actually aggregate that data. That took us a lot of time for many reasons. Because one, we were doing it on the side. It was a part-time project. We had full-time jobs, but we're just doing those on the side. Two was that we didn't have funds, so we had to sort of do that. So it took about 6 months for us to curate all those data and then upload the data. And eventually, we started working on that. So one of the things I did was I was able to convince a couple of people to work on this project. The idea was that we're building something that was a force, that was unique, that was going to make a difference. And then that's, you know, you could sort of put on your portfolio that I was part of the group that worked on this. So we did that. And it took a while too, because we had to sort of build a couple of models, try to validate them, and then try to see if the recommendations they were giving was like very useful by, you know, sort of conducting human validation of the outputs they were having. The other thing we did to make it more robust was that we conducted a public survey of people's experiences using existing health insurance companies.
I understand it was quite a challenge to build a model due to a lack of existing data. To solve this, you aggregated a lot of data, built a model, and validated it by human feedback. Now, after that, how did you deploy the model?
So initially, we had a website. We built a front end for that. So people could go to that website and input. So the way we did it was that we created a user interface that was easy. So you go to the website, you are asked a couple of questions. I think it would be about 8 questions about your preferences. And then once you enter that, the algorithm on the back end works and then recommends based on your preferences for what health insurance would be the best for you. And then you get a recommendation of 3. You see 3, it shows you 3 health insurance plans that you could choose from. People found it very useful. People tried it out. We even got into a program based on that where we had some sort of training to sort of see how we can build it better. The challenge we had eventually was that there was really no way to sort of monetize that process in a way for us to make it sustainable. Because so eventually the realization was that this is a public good that people needed, but for us to keep running it, we needed to have funds because, you know, we had to host this in the cloud. We needed engineers that would maintain this, and everybody was busy. It was a side project. It was like a passion project that we built. So what we eventually did was that we decided to open source the tool and then put it on GitHub for free. And then we sort of, you know, wrote an article on that and then put it out on MedSieve. And then one of the things we found out was that a couple of startups actually now refactored the code and integrated into their project. So I think there are like 2 startups like that, because I still checked the GitHub that have sort of refactored the code and added to their process. So that was the output, I mean, the outcome of that project. You know, it helped people. At the time when we released it and were testing it, people used it to sort of make their decision about what healthcare plan was the best for them. People found it very useful. We got a lot of very good feedback on that. But, you know, we really couldn't sustain it because there was really no business case for us in that sense. So we just decided to open source it and then put it on the web. So it's still there. The data is free. We open the data for free. The code is free. Anybody can go there, pick it up and refactor, which is what people have been doing already. So that was like the outcome of that specific project.
I'm sorry to hear that you could not continue this project, but I appreciate that you published the code and everybody can access and use it. Let's move on to the second project you were involved in. During COVID, you built a COVID triage system which calculates the risk of exposure to COVID-19. Could you tell us more about the background of this project?
Yeah, so the second project was an interesting one. I was in the US at the time. And, you know, when COVID broke out, we had all these shelter in place where people stayed in their houses. There were these lockdowns, and, you know, people couldn't go to the healthcare institutions except you had an emergency. You could not come in. That was like the rule at the time. So I was sort of thinking of, you know, what could we do using technology to sort of make it easier for people to understand, one, their risk of exposure to COVID. To understand COVID itself, because it was new. It was new to a lot of people, even though a couple of us had more insight, but it was new to a lot of people. They didn't even understand what the whole thing was about. And then 3, to understand what to do if they had suspicions that they are COVID or not. So, and that was what sort of motivated the idea. So I was in the US. So sort of, as at the time, we were still running the startup that I said we ran for 5 years. So I spoke with a couple of people on my team, and we decided to see if we could find a way to abstract the case definition for COVID into a digital model that people could easily access from anywhere. So one of the things we did was that I sort of brought together a small team. So I brought together a full stack developer, brought together a couple of clinicians. I'm a clinician myself, but I felt like, you know, for this kind of project, we needed more expertise to sort of collaborate with mine. So we brought in an epidemiologist, and then we brought in a couple of people to work on the project. And so we sat down and said, what could we do? What could we build rather? And then we decided to sort of, you know, design. So I sort of wrote the design for the tool, what it would work like, reviewed it with the team, and then we started working. And then in 2 weeks, we wrote something out. And as at that time, there was nobody on the continent that had built or rolled out anything of that nature. People were still sort of either, you go online, you look at the paper. The paper has these checks, like you check them. Someone asks you a question or you call a number or something, which was not very accessible to a lot of people. So we rolled that out. And then when we rolled it out, the response was massive. Like it was crazy. Like there were so many people that were trying to use that kind of tool because people wanted to understand their risk. People wanted to understand what COVID meant. And people wanted to understand what to do in case they had exposure or the risk. So the way we built it then was we used a simple rule-based method where it will tell you about your risk. So you have high risk, medium, low, and low risk. And then we sort of put an explanation of what each of those things meant. That was the initial thing we built. And then when it was really getting a lot of buzz, we decided to rebuild it so that it could scale much better. And eventually, you know, it was used by over 1.5 million people across Africa.
That's impressive. And there seemed to be an urgent need for such a tool. Let's go into more details about the model. You already mentioned that it was rule-based. Can you specify what the triage tool specifically measured and how it was used?
Yes. So the triage system. So a triage system is basically is a system where you try to use it to sort of what I would say in simple terms is to categorize people. So it's used across multiple areas. So for example, if you have a mass accident scene. You try to triage your patients based on the level of casualty they are. So you triage them based on who should we attend to first. So the triage system helps you to say, this is urgent, this is next to urgent, this can wait, and then this does not need to be seen. So the idea behind the triage tool for COVID was that we're using the case definition for COVID to say, this person is high risk for COVID. Wasn't it a diagnosis tool? Triage systems are usually not diagnostic. They are meant to just give you an idea on the level of risk or the level of exposure that someone has. So the way the COVID triage tool worked was that based on a couple of questions you answered, have you been exposed to someone with COVID? Have you recently traveled somewhere? Have you had this and that? It will say your risk of exposure to COVID is high. If you answer the questions in a specific kind of way, it will say your risk of exposure, your risk of COVID is medium. And then if, let's say, you answer no to everything, then your score threshold is low. It does not mean that any of those triage categories are exact, but it sort of gives you an idea of the fact that, okay, this person has a high risk of exposure to COVID. He might have COVID. What should we do? Let's test him. So triage system helps you to sort of manage, it helps you to manage logistics, it helps you to manage human resource, and it helps you to manage a couple of other areas. So for example, you would be more focused on testing people with high exposure rather than people with low exposure. Because, you know, a lot of these resources are not unlimited. So for you to be able to manage them better, the triage system helps you to know who to focus on next, and who you can sort of wait a little bit before you focus on them. So that was the idea behind the triage too. And it's a very common kind of approach that is used across healthcare, even without using AI or digital tools. But that's like the basic idea of what a triage does.
I am now wondering, did the government support your idea and use your model?
One of the things that came out from that was that the Nigerian CDC adopted it as one of their official triage tools. The number one teaching hospital in Nigeria adopted it as one of the official triage tools. A couple of other organizations adopted it as one of the official triage tools. We were able to get a grant then to sort of, you know, expand it, build it better, make it more scalable. We got a couple of, you know, recognitions. It really gave us a lot of visibility at the time.
It's great to hear that you got support from the government. You mentioned that other countries in Africa were interested in using the model you have developed. Can you explain how the model was adapted for other countries?
And then one of the things that also happened was that the World Health Organization, the Afro region, gave us a contract based on the tool to sort of rebuild the tool and deploy it for South Sudan. South Sudan is the youngest country in Africa. So we're able to get a contract with WHO where we rebuilt that tool, factored it, and we deployed it for the whole country under WHO. What we did differently for South Sudan was that in Nigeria, there is more internet access. A lot of more people have more smartphones, even though it's not everyone. But in South Sudan, that was the dynamic was a little bit different. So we rebuilt it in a way that this thing could work on a device. So it was hosted fully on a device, and then you could synchronize the data at the end to a cloud. So you didn't need the internet; you just had the device. And then, in this case, it was built for healthcare workers to use in conducting the triaging for people, unlike when people had to go and use it themselves. So we had a lot of those kind of feedbacks. And the other thing was that it also became a sort of surveillance tool. So with it, because one of the things we added into the tool was that you could report your location, you could file a report, you could send a report of, okay, this is where I am, these are challenges I'm having, and someone could really call you. So it sort of become a surveillance tool. So some of the data we had could be used to sort of see where, okay, people in this area are having like high risks. What could be happening in that area? Could sort of go and look at that area and say, what is happening there? Why are people from this area reporting high risk of COVID, you know, compared to people in other areas? And then sort of built in a couple of other things where if you needed to file a report, once you're done with the triage, you can enter your location and show you who to report to, who to call and everything like that, and other things that you could do. So it was really very pivotal for us. We're featured in a couple of publications. I think the World Economic Forum featured our project. I think WHO featured our project. A lot of features just came about. You know, we were sort of quoted in a couple of publications about tools that were helping to fight COVID. We wrote an article on that, got it published in an academic journal. And you know, the feedback was just really massive. It was like one of the pivotal things that we were able to do. And I would say it's one of the things I feel proud about the most in my career in AI, digital science, and in health information sciences.
Great, thank you. We now looked at already some really interesting applications of AI in Africa. What are for you some of the current applications of AI in medicine across Africa that you find most exciting or impactful?
Yes, so that's a very interesting question. And you know, as we all know right now, everybody wants to apply AI to anything. You know, you talk about there's this challenge, people want to throw AI at it. And, you know, that's something that is, you know, getting very rampant. And the reality is that, you know, a lot of those things do not work the way people expect them to work for multiple reasons. But on the African continent specifically, we have a lot of very interesting and superb outcomes. So TU Delft is a Dutch university that usually has this very fantastic departments where they focus on building digital solutions, especially with the focus on developing countries and low to middle income countries. So what TU Delft did was that what they were trying to do was that they saw a problem of the fact that, you know, one of the highest causes of death on the African continent is tuberculosis. And it's also one of the commonest things that kill people who have AIDS, so to speak. So one of the challenges with managing TB is that you need to diagnose it. And a lot of people go undiagnosed. And even people that do not go undiagnosed, time to diagnose it for at times takes too long because of a lot of logistic challenges. So what TU Delft decided to do was that, is there a way we could use AI to speed up the process of that diagnosis? Let's sort of step back a bit. The usual process is that someone goes out, a radiographer takes images, and then they put those images together, and then they send it to an expert who goes through those images painstakingly to be sure that, okay, this person has TB. He looks at a couple of features. Now, the interesting thing with, you know, viewing X-ray is that it's like you're trying to recognize patterns. So you see something here, or you see an opacity in this place, and then you see the way some things are sort of shaped, and then you say, okay, this person has TB or not. Or you see some sort of dot somewhere, and then you say, okay, this person has TB or not. That's the way the system works. But the challenge is that, let's say, for example, you take x-rays of 150 people that the diagnosis is TB. Now, if you look at those 150, you can imagine the amount of time it will take for one person to cycle through those 150. And the challenge is that, you know, TB is sort of very rampant on the African continent. So there are lots of people. So we're talking about more than 150. In a week, you could have about 300, 400 people being tested. A lot of them would not have TB, but you still need to review those ones. And remember, the challenge that exists on ground is the fact that, one, there are not enough x-rays all around for people to get that diagnosis. Two is that one of the standards that they use in diagnosing TB in a lot of places is called GeneXpert. GeneXpert machines are very expensive. They're like very expensive. A whole area, like a whole local government, can have just two in the whole area. And that's an area that's covering, let's say, about 5 million people. So it takes a long time for tests to come back. So what CATVDV did was that one of the first things they did was that they built a system to use mobile, they used mobile x-rays. So they were using mobile x-rays to get x-ray diagnosis closer to the people. They now decided to build an AI system on those collected x-rays to see how they can speed up the rate of turnaround time for those diagnoses. Now, remember, the other challenge with x-rays is that you can have a lot of x-rays, but there are not enough radiologists. So CAD4TB was trying to solve two problems. Trying to solve the problem of access to diagnosis and then access to experts, to the expertise needed to confirm diagnosis. So with the AI, we're able to sort of cycle through more x-rays very quickly. And their impact is so great that they're sort of integrated with a lot of national TB programs across about 9 countries in Africa. They are in about 19 countries across the world. So they're like making that specific impact. They're helping to sort of speed up the diagnosis of TB and indirectly save millions of lives annually. And to me, that's like one of the most impactful use of AI.
Okay, so if I understand correctly, the key challenges in diagnosing tuberculosis, which you call TB, include a limited number of available x-ray machines, the high cost of expert diagnosis, and the lengthy time required to obtain results. To address these issues, two main steps were taken. First, mobile x-ray units were developed to increase the accessibility and reduce costs. And second, an AI system was designed to accelerate the diagnostic process. Now focusing on the AI system, could you explain in detail how this AI system functions for diagnosing TB?
Those images can be quickly run through AI much faster because, you know, it's like, if it take me like 10, 15 minutes to review the x-ray, and AI does it in 1/10 of the time. So once the AI does that, it puts out a recommendation. And then, so but the good thing is that the AI is not the one that makes the final decision. No. What the AI has done is that it has reduced the amount of cognitive load that I need to deal with for me to review the x-ray. So the AI reviews the x-ray and then it comes to me, who is the expert? Then I validate this is correct or not. So instead of spending 15 minutes, with the help of the AI, the time I spend significantly reduces. So that is the way the AI works. So the AI sort of just tells you, sort of gives you an insight into what could be happening in that specific x-ray. And I could tell you that, okay, this is here, this exists, based on this, this is a recommendation. So that's the way it sort of works in a sort of nutshell.
Now, taking this case as an example, what would be your recommendation for how doctors should use this AI diagnostic tool effectively? While the algorithm can significantly speed up the diagnostic process, there is inherent risk of errors, meaning doctors should not solely depend on the AI findings. How would you suggest balancing the use of this AI tool with traditional diagnostic methods to ensure accuracy and patient safety?
So the recommendation for the use of AI tools is that, no, as a clinician, you'd still should rely on your clinical expertise for the final decision. So the AI is an assistant. That's the best way I would say clinicians should look at those AI tools. An assistant is more or less like the AI is helping me to sort of reason through the process. So it's just like the way I want to seek a second opinion. Yeah, it's like giving me a second opinion on what I'm looking at. Yeah, it's telling me that there are things I could miss. So for example, because the AI is very good at pattern recognition, there are things I could miss that the AI could point out. But like you said, the AI is not perfect. It could be wrong too, which is why whatever recommendation it gives, I need to review it and confirm that this recommendation is correct. So the idea is that people should sort of focus more when they're building these tools on augmenting the capacity of clinicians. And clinicians sort of understand the fact that these tools are not perfect. They are very useful, they are helpful, but they're not perfect. And you should verify before you affirm whatever recommendation they give. See it as a sort of assistant that is supporting your decision-making process. It's not the decision maker for you. You are the final decision maker. Because you know, the reality is that you know, if something goes wrong down the line and someone wants to be held accountable for maybe malpractice or for not offering the best service, if you as a clinician just accept the AI tool and you get to court, you can't go to the court and say, I followed the AI, I agree to the AI. No, you're a clinician. You're trained to make that decision. You're actually the one who's supposed to make that decision. The AI is just sort of meant to help you in that decision-making process. So, and that's one of the biggest challenges that the concerns people have with the use of AI in healthcare. Now, there's this challenge of the fact that there's a name they call it. It has a specific name in the field where people use a system so much that at a point, they stop fact-checking the system. They just sort of take the output of the system at face value, because they've gotten so used to it. And it's something that happens very often. It doesn't just happen in AI. It happens across multiple areas. It's like, you know, like the internet. When people are getting information, they will just say, the internet said so. And that's something that can happen in anywhere. That can happen in any profession or to anyone. So it's the same thing. So that's one of the things we need to sort of guard against. Why are we training clinicians to use AI? We must always admire into them the fact that the AI can and do have failures. It has flaws. It's not perfect. So you should ensure that you check the AI and you ensure that you confirm using your own clinical expertise what output it gives you before sort of using that to make a final clinical decision. So that's the idea.
Thank you so much for your insights. It was great to have you here, and I'm looking forward to discuss the potential and some of the challenges of AI in Africa with you on our next episode.
Yeah, same here. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and thanks for asking these questions and thanks for bringing up this discussion. They're very important.